Namaste. Welcome tonight. We finish chapter 7 in book 2 of The Life Divine, The Knowledge and the Ignorance. We have seen that Sri Aurobindo has surveying the real nature of the cosmos, found that at every level it is invested with divine being, which is also conscious, and that this consciousness is not absent of power, of force. So all the stadia of existence, all the 7 planes, sat, chit, ananda, vijnana, manas, prana, anam, all are reflective and all are included in the being of the divine, which is not merely a static reality transcendent to all manifestation, to all movement, but indwells. It is inside of it. There is nothing that is outside this being. This great omnipresent reality includes it. Whatever it is that you point at, whatever state of awareness you ascend to, you are always within that and only that. So then, this opposition between knowledge, vidya, and ignorance, avidya, is in some ways a false antinomy, because Sri Aurobindo posits that ignorance is a deliberate restriction of this conscious force. And what results from that is a finitizing of the infinite. The form comes out of the formless, but does not deny that from which it came, but rather expresses it richly, manifoldly, in the innumerable features of the universe. So, if we are to understand what is real knowledge, a greater knowledge that includes everything that seems to deny and fragment it, then we have to achieve not a superb logic, but we have to achieve a transcendent experience, a kind of experience which is penetrating, which is ensphering. Which exceeds the strands of reason and arrives beyond an exclusive view at an integrative, whole view. So this is where we were when we stopped last time. Let's continue with the last couple of sentences of that paragraph that we left. It sort of sets the tone for what we will be in. There must be some manifold truth of the one reality which is reflected, however falsely or imperfectly, in the manifold images of the mind's universe. It could then very well be that the world might be a reality and only the mind's construction of it or picture of it erroneous or imperfect. But this would imply that there is a knowledge other than our mental thought and perception, which is only an attempt at knowing, a true cognition, which is aware of the reality and aware also in it of the truth of a real universe. So he calls us to a supra-rational station where we become aware of the essential truth and the universe as one and the same thing. Essence and manifestation are the same. Now, for if we found that the highest reality and an ignorant mind alone exist, we might have no choice but to admit the ignorance as an original power of the Brahman, and to accept as the source of all things avidya or maya. Maya would be an eternal power of the self-aware Brahman to delude itself, or rather, to delude something that seems to be itself, something created by Maya. Mind would be the ignorant consciousness of a soul that exists only as a part of Maya. Maya would be the Brahman's power to foist name and form upon itself. Mind, its power to receive them and take them for realities. Or, Maya would be Brahman's power to create illusions, knowing them to be illusions. Mind, its power to receive illusions, forgetting that they are illusions. So this relationship between Maya and mind, either in terms of ignorance or in terms of illusion. These are arguments, of course, that we've met before as he looked at the principal theses of Advaita in the last couple of chapters. To continue, but if Brahman is essentially and always one in self-awareness, this trick would not be possible. If Brahman can divide itself in that fashion, at once knowing and not knowing, or one part knowing and the other not knowing, or even if it can be put something of itself into Maya, then Brahman must be capable of a double or a manifold action of consciousness. One, a consciousness of reality, the other a consciousness of illusion, or one, an ignorant consciousness, and the other, a superconscience. This duality or manifoldness seems at first sight logically impossible. Yet it must be on this hypothesis, the crucial fact of existence, a spiritual mystery, a suprarational paradox beyond the reason. But once we admit the origin of things as a suprarational mystery, we can equally or preferably accept this other crucial fact of the one becoming or being always many, and the many being or becoming the one. This too is at first view dialectically impossible, a suprarational paradox, yet it presents itself to us as an eternal fact and law of existence. So, a contradiction in language and logic is not a contradiction in fact of being. So he continues, but if that is accepted, there is then no longer any need for the intervention of an elusive Maya. Or equally, we can accept, as we have accepted, the conception of an infinite and eternal which is capable by the infinite power of its consciousness of manifesting the fathomless and illimitable truth of its being in many aspects and processes, in innumerable expressive forms and movements. These aspects, processes, forms, movements could be regarded as real expressions, real consequences of its infinite reality. Even the inconscience and ignorance could then be accepted among them as reverse aspects, as powers of an involved consciousness and a self-limited knowledge brought forward because necessary to a certain movement in time, a movement of involution and evolution of the reality. If suprarational in its basis, this total conception is not altogether a paradox. It only demands a change and enlargement in our conceptions of the infinite. And this is a succinct statement of his actual view. Inconscience and ignorance are aspects of a self-limited knowledge, and knowledge is itself an aspect of that conscious force, chit shakti. He continues, but the world cannot be known, and none of these possibilities can be put to the test if we consider mind only, or only mind's power for ignorance. Because then we're locked into dialectic, we're locked into dualism because of the way nature and mind, pardon me, the nature of mind divides, can only arrive at a conclusion by distinguishing elements and then trying to rationally construct an image of what they represent in their integral reality. Never gets to the essence of things. But is that all that mind is? Let's start again. But the real world cannot be known, and none of these possibilities can be put to the test if we consider mind alone or only mind's power for ignorance. Mind has a power also for truth. It opens its thought chamber to vidya as well as to avidya. And if its starting point is ignorance, if its passage is through crooked ways of error, still its goal is always knowledge. There is in it an impulse of truth-seeking, a power, even though secondary and limited, of truth-finding and truth-creation. Even if it is only images or representations or abstract expressions of truth that it can show us, still these are in their own manner truth reflections or truth formations, and the realities of which they are forms are present in their more concrete truth in some deeper depth or on some higher level of power of our consciousness. Matter and life may be the form of realities of which mind touches only an incomplete figure. Spirit may have secret and supernal realities of which mind is only a partial and rudimentary receiver, transcriber, or transmitter. It would then be only by an examination of other supramental and inframental, as well as higher and deeper mental powers of consciousness, that we can arrive at the whole reality. And in the end, all depends on the truth of the supreme consciousness, or the superconscience, that belongs to the highest reality and the relation to it of mind, supermind, inframind, and the inconscience. So he has established that there are various modes or agencies of consciousness interrelated in a supreme consciousness. And this world order that he looks at here is in terms of awareness. So on the tops, the superconscience, and at the bottom, the inconscience. A mind looks up to a supermind and looks down below to an inframind. Supramental means above the mental, and inframental means below the mental. So the reaches of those regions of awareness are varied. Some fully disclose the nature of the integrated self, and some hide, conceal, disguise, restrict, compress. All indeed changes when we penetrate the lower and the higher depths of consciousness and unite them in the one omnipresent reality. If we take the facts of our and the world's being, we find existence to be one always. A unity governs even its utmost multiplicity. But the multiplicity is also, on the face of things, undeniable. We have found unity pursuing us everywhere. Even when we go below the surface, we find that there is no binding dualism. The contradictories and oppositions which the intellect creates exist only as aspects of the original truth. Oneness and multiplicity are poles of the same reality. The dualities that trouble our consciousness are contrasted truths of one and the same truth of being. An omnipresent reality can only be single. It cannot be divided into two. This is the core truth behind the Advaita philosophy. Sri Aurobindo calls his philosophy Purna Advaita, the full non-dualism, which incorporates into its view the expression of the universe. All multiplicity resolves itself into a manifoldness of the one being, the one consciousness of being, the one delight of being. So we're back to Satchit-Ananda. Thus, in the duality of pleasure and pain, we have seen that pain is a contrary effect of the one delight of existence resulting from the weakness of the recipient, his inability to assimilate the force that meets him, his incapacity to bear the touch of delight that would otherwise be felt in it. It is a perverse reaction of consciousness to Ananda, not itself a fundamental opposite of Ananda. This is shown by the significant fact that pain can pass into pleasure and pleasure into pain, and both resolve into the original Ananda. So too, every form of weakness is really a particular working of the one divine will force or the one cosmic energy. Weakness in that force means its power to hold back, measure, relate in a particular way its action of force. Incapacity or weakness is the self's withholding of its force completeness or an insufficient reaction of force, not its fundamental opposite. If this is so, then also it may be and should be in the nature of things that what we call ignorance is not really anything else than a power of the one divine knowledge, will, or Maya. It is the capacity of the one consciousness similarly to regulate, to hold back, measure, relate in a particular way the action of its knowledge. And this is, in fact, how he views the power of Maya. Maya is the nature of the divine consciousness to deliberately restrict and measure out from its infinitude some portion to aspect it as a world, to configure, literally to configure, to invest with name and form something that symbolizes and expresses the immensitude of its own conscious being. And so too at every scale of being and multiplied endlessly throughout all the worlds which combined represent the single manifestation of the divine. However many universes they are all included in that one being. So you can see that the various bands of conscious being from Satchit-Ananda all the way into the inconscience below matter are in a sense like the spectrum of a rainbow, ranging from one shade all the way to the other side, but all of it part of that single being, but expressing something that is transcendent to all those colors. Not all of them added together, but something that is beyond all coloration. So let's read that last bit again. If this is so, then also it may be, and should be in the nature of things, that what we call ignorance is not really anything else than a power of the one divine knowledge, will, or Maya. It is the capacity of the one consciousness similarly to regulate, to hold back, measure, relate in a particular way the action of its knowledge. So, if we say Satchit-Ananda, we can look at Satchit-Ananda as expressing itself in the universe through the application of its conscious force, because no expression is unconscious. From Satchit-Ananda there can only be conscious action, and its action must be pure. Its consciousness must express itself as knowledge. Its force must express itself as will. And if conscious force wishes to restrict itself, then the product of that restricted consciousness we could rightly call ignorance. This is ignorance which measures out multiplicity and relates all the multiplied figures of self together. Knowledge and ignorance will then be not two irreconcilable principles, one creative of world existence, the other intolerant and destructive of it, but two coexistent powers, both present in the universe itself, diversely operating in the conduct of its processes, but one in their essence, and able to pass by a natural transmutation into each other. But in their fundamental relation, ignorance would not be an equal coexistent. It would be dependent on knowledge, a limitation or a contrary action of knowledge. So yes, ignorance derives from knowledge. But while it may limp, it can learn to walk. It is key that we recognize this possibility of transmutation that he's mentioned here. Because while we begin with limited awareness, restricted knowledge, we can build upon that and get to the essence of all things and arrive at an integrated knowledge which combines and synthesizes all that we meet in cosmos, all of that founded upon the original divinity which is beyond, which is transcendent. To know, he writes, we have always to dissolve the rigid constructions of the ignorant and self-willed intellect and look freely and flexibly at the facts of existence. Its fundamental fact is consciousness, which is power. Facts of existence, sat. Fundamental fact of consciousness, chit, which is power, tapas, shakti. First, and we actually see that this power has three ways of operating. First, we find that there is a consciousness behind all, embracing all, within all, which is eternally, universally, absolutely aware of itself, whether in unity or multiplicity, or in both simultaneously, or beyond both in its sheer absolute. This is the plenitude of the supreme divine self-knowledge. It is also the plenitude of the divine all-knowledge. Essential equals universal. Divine self-knowledge is the same thing as the divine all-knowledge. Next, at the other pole of things, we see this consciousness dwelling upon apparent oppositions in itself. And the most extreme antinomy of all reaches its acme in what seems to us to be a complete nescience of itself, an effective, dynamic, creative inconscience, though we know that this is merely a surface appearance and that the divine knowledge works with a sovereign security and sureness within the operations of the inconscient. So, the first is the all-embracing awareness. The second is this oppositional capacity of consciousness to be above in the superconscient and yet represent itself as the inconscience in which all that light seems to have lapsed into absolute darkness, but which has secretly at its roots this supreme light still present. Paramjyoti is still there in that darkness. Apraketam salilam. Between these two oppositions, and as a mediary term, we see consciousness working with a partial limited self-awareness, which is equally superficial. For behind it and acting through it is the divine all-knowledge. Here, in its intermediate status, it seems to be a standing compromise between the two opposites, between the supreme consciousness and the nescience. but may prove rather, in a larger view of our data, to be an incomplete emergence of the knowledge to the surface. This compromise, or imperfect emergence, we call the ignorance, from our own point of view, because ignorance is our own characteristic way of the soul's self-withholding of complete self-knowledge. Ah, that imitates another creative act above it, no? The origin of these three poises of the power of consciousness and their exact relation is what we have, if possible, to discover. If we discovered that ignorance and knowledge were two independent powers of consciousness, but they aren't, it might then be that we would have to pursue their difference up to the highest point of consciousness, where they would cease only in an absolute from which both of them had issued together. We have a footnote. Let's read it. In the Upanishads, Vidya and Avidya are spoken of as eternal in the Supreme Brahman. But this can be accepted in the sense of the consciousness of the multiplicity and the consciousness of the oneness, which by coexistence in the supreme self-awareness became the basis of the manifestation. They would there be two sides of an eternal self-knowledge. And refer back to the beginning of the chapter where he was translating a verse from the Shvetashvatara Upanishad, chapter 5, verse 1. Back to the top, to the main text. It might then be concluded, pardon me, that the only real knowledge is the truth of the superconscient absolute, and that truth of consciousness, truth of cosmos, truth of ourselves in cosmos, is at best a partial figure burdened always with a concomitant presence, an encircling penumbra, a pursuing shadow of ignorance. It might even be that an absolute knowledge establishing truth, harmony, order, and an absolute inconscience basing a play of fantasy, disharmony, and disorder, supporting inexorably its extreme of falsehood, wrong, and suffering, a Manichaean double principle of conflicting and intermingling light and darkness, good and evil, stand at the root of cosmic existence. You know Manichaeism? That's the two principles of existence, light and good, perpetually, eternally fighting evil and darkness. From money, also called Manichaeus, who lived in what used to be called Ekdabana, which is now part of Iraq, third century CE. Born of a Jewish Gnostic parents, by the way. This idea of light and dark always fighting. Principles which divide the cosmos. Absolute dualism. Which Sri Aurobindo necessarily rejects. The idea of certain thinkers that there is an absolute good but also an absolute evil, both of them an approach to the absolute, might assume consistence, if we accepted that. But if we find that knowledge and ignorance are light and shadow of the same consciousness, that the beginning of ignorance is a limitation of knowledge, that it is the limitation that opens the door to a subordinate possibility of partial illusion and error, that this possibility takes full body after a purposeful plunge of knowledge into a material inconscience, but that knowledge too emerges along with an emerging consciousness out of the inconscience, then we can be sure that this fullness of ignorance is by its own evolution changing back into a limited knowledge, and can feel the assurance that the limitation itself will be removed, and that the full truth of things become apparent, the cosmic truth free itself from the cosmic ignorance, which is where we are now. The idea of an involution of consciousness into, at bottom, an inconscient, and then an evolution of that hidden consciousness out of that darkness back to reclaim its light, true selfhood, and full plenary knowledge. In fact, what is happening is that the ignorance is seeking and preparing to transform itself by a progressive illumination of its darknesses into the knowledge that is already concealed within it. The cosmic truth manifested in its real essence and figure would, by that transformation, reveal itself as essence and figure of the supreme omnipresent reality. And remember that Sri Aurobindo titled the first book of the Life Divine, The Omnipresent Reality. So you can see here that he's speaking in terms that ignorance is not in application here only to the scale of the individual. This is scaled at a cosmic, even at a societal level. It is from this interpretation of existence that we have started. But to verify it, we must observe the structure of our surface consciousness and its relation to what is within it and above and below it. For so best we can distinguish the nature and scope of the ignorance. In that process, there will appear the nature and scope also of that of which the ignorance is a limitation and deformation, the knowledge. In its totality, the spiritual being's abiding self-knowledge and world knowledge. That concludes the chapter. Next, memory, self-consciousness, and the ignorance. In other words, the nature of the self and its awareness. So we'll take that up next week, but we are nigh upon the 15th here in America, and already it is the 15th in India. So I thought we could draw some lines from Savitri tonight, which were written by Sri Aurobindo about Ashwapati, the great king, but which could have been written about himself as well. This is in Book 1, the Book of Beginnings, Canto 5, The Yoga of the Spirit's Freedom and Greatness. A will, a hope immense, now seized his heart, and to discern the superhuman's form, he raised his eyes to unseen spiritual heights, aspiring to bring down a greater world. The glory he had glimpsed must be his home. A brighter, heavenlier sun must soon illume this dusk room with its dark internal stare, the infant's soul in its small nursery school, mid objects meant for a lesson hardly learned, outgrow its early grammar of intellect and its imitation of earth nature's art, its earthly dialect to God language change, in living symbols study reality, and learn the logic of the infinite. The ideal must be nature's common truth, the body illumined with the indwelling God, the heart and mind feel one with all that is, a conscious soul live in a conscious world. As through a mist a sovereign peak is seen, the greatness of the eternal spirit appeared, exiled in a fragmented universe amid half-semblances of diviner things. These now could serve no more his regal turn. The immortal's pride refused the doom to live, a miser of the scanty bargain made between our littleness and bounded hopes and the compassionate infinitudes. His height repelled the lowness of earth's state, a wideness discontented with its frame, resiled from poor assent to nature's terms, the harsh contract spurned, and the diminished lease. Only beginnings are accomplished here. Our base's matter seems alone complete, an absolute machine without a soul. Or all seems a misfit of half-ideas, or we saddle with the vice of earthly form a hurried imperfect glimpse of heavenly things, guesses and travesties of celestial types. Here chaos sorts itself into a world, a brief formation drifting in the void. Apings of knowledge, unfinished arcs of power, flamings of beauty into earthly shapes, love's broken reflexes of unity swim, fragment mirrorings of a floating sun. A packed assemblage of crude, tentative lives are pieced into a tessellated whole. There is no perfect answer to our hopes. There are blind, voiceless doors that have no key. Thought climbs in vain and brings a borrowed light, cheated by counterfeits, sold to us in life's mart. Our hearts clutch at a forfeited heavenly bliss. There is provender for the mind's satiety. There are thrills of the flesh, but not the soul's desire. Here, even the highest rapture time can give is a mimicry of ungrasped beatitudes, a mutilated statue of ecstasy, a wounded happiness that cannot live, a brief felicity of mind or sense thrown by the world power to a body's slave, or a simulacrum of enforced delight in the seraglios of ignorance. For all we have acquired soon loses worth, an old disvalued credit in time's bank, imperfection's check drawn on the inconscient. An inconsequence dogs every effort made, and chaos waits on every cosmos formed. In each success, a seed of failure lurks. He saw the doubtfulness of all things here, the incertitude of man's proud, confident thought, the transience of the achievements of his force. A thinking being in an unthinking world, an island in the sea of the unknown, he is a smallness trying to be great, an animal with some instincts of a god, his life a story too common to be told, his deeds a number summing up to naught, his consciousness a torch lit to be quenched, his hope a star above a cradle and grave. And yet, a greater destiny may be his, for the eternal spirit is his truth. He can recreate himself and all around, and fashion new the world in which he lives. He, ignorant, is the knower beyond time. He is the self above nature, above fate. So, it is the 15th of August in India. Not merely the date of India's independence, which is a blow for the freedom of the globe from ignorance. Tonight we have spoken about rising out of ignorance and into knowledge. And India is the natural leader of the world in that vast adventure. It is the home of the Sanatana Dharma, of the eternal truth that works itself out in time. And Sri Aurobindo, born 144 years ago, 12 dozen years ago, perfection upon perfection, perfection multiplying perfection, carried the lamp for us, a lamp that he lit and called us back to the affirmations of the Spirit. Not to leave the earth, to abandon it, to hie away to some far heaven, Vaikuntha, but to bring heaven here, to transform this globe, to disclose consciousness from darkness, to liberate for the heart's delight the ananda that sleeps in nature, for us to participate in that, was the beckoning that brought us down. We've come here to join him in that adventure. I think we form, if anything, an army of light. And what we have to conquer is not anything external, but the darkness that divides us from each other, from a true and sure knowledge of the soul force that sleeps within us, often unused, often unseen, but which, if stirred to wakefulness and brought to the surface, can charm and harmonize the globe and make it a worthy place for the evolution into that supramental light that Sri Aurobindo prophesied is our next conquest. So, let's conquer ignorance and proceed to bliss and to knowledge. Let's bring Satchit Ananda here. Make it tangible. So, it is a happy birthday for us all. Happy birthday to a liberated India. Happy birthday to Sri Aurobindo. Happy birthday to you all. And namaste. Jai Ma.